This is an EcoNews Report Encore presentation, originally aired February 26, 2015.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host this week, Jennifer Kalt, Director of Humboldt Baykeeper. The EcoNews Report is brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the EcoNews. Today, my guest is Bob Rowan, who is here to talk about his new book, about his experiences as a nuclear control technician and whistleblower at the PG&E Humboldt Bay Nuclear Power Plant at King Salmon. Thanks so much for being on the EcoNews Report today.
You're welcome.
The Humboldt Bay Nuclear Power Plant at King Salmon was the first commercially licensed nuclear power plant in the United States. It was operated from 1963 to 1976. The decommissioning is continuing today. It cost $33 million to build that plant. And then after 13 years of operation, it was shut down for a variety of reasons, including earthquake faults that were underneath the power plant. But it's cost over $900 million, almost $1 billion for the decommissioning to date, and they're still not done. Currently, PG&E is in the process of developing its final site restoration plan, which will entail what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission calls license termination. So after that point, in a couple years, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the federal agency that oversees nuclear power plants, will, quote-unquote, sign off that the site is closed, it's done, it's restored, and the only thing that will remain is all the high-level radioactive waste that was ever produced at that plant is stored in underground casks on the top of the hill at King Salmon. And, you know, the federal government has promised since the beginning of nuclear power in this country to find a repository for all this fuel. And so far, no repository has been established. I can only assume that we will live with that nuclear waste here on Humboldt Bay till the end of time, whenever that may come, or, you know, some of that radioactive material has a half-life of 6,500 years. So long, long time, certainly beyond my lifetime. Bob, why don't you talk a little bit about the new book?
Boris Williams and I, nuclear control technician that I worked with, blew the whistle on PG&E, and we both were fired because of it.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. So you became a nuclear control technician at the PG&E plant in what year?
In 1964. The background story to that is that when I was in the Marine Corps, I was in a force reconnaissance unit as a paramarine pathfinder. This was back in the day when the Cold War was hot and heavy with the threat of the deployment of nuclear tactical weapons on the battlefield. So I was trained in ABC warfare, atomic, biological, and chemical warfare. I received training in radiation protection and the concerns over radiation safety. And then when I ended up going to work for PG&E and I wound up at the power plant, almost within 6 months, promoted to apprentice nuclear control technician. And I obviously went through PG&E's version of radiation protection training and found that what they were telling us was not in sync with what I had learned in the military. So I started asking questions, and that led to confrontation because I was told that I would be better off staying with PG&E material rather than whatever it was I was referring to as radiation safety. And I had too much Marine in me in those days, and I would not allow myself to be intimidated or coerced into the kinds of mindset that they wanted me to have. And I wasn't the only technician that felt that way because bad things were beginning to happen at that plant.
So you started in 1964. You were fired in 1970 because of your questioning of many, many things that were happening at that plant. And I've read a good number of these stories in your book. It's really quite hair-raising. Tell a few of the stories about the kinds of things that went on and concerns that you raised that led to your becoming a whistleblower. The GNR metal story. The GNR metal site was just recently remediated. It was cleaned up by Union Pacific. It was a former junkyard. And it was in the news because while they were doing the excavation there for all the contaminated soils, they found an unexploded bomb. They had cleared out a couple blocks of Old Town Eureka. And it made me wonder at the time, geez, I wonder what else is there that no one knows about. Tell that story first, the GNR metal story. What happened?
Okay, we routinely made clean area surveys to make sure that no radioactive materials or equipment had left the controlled area of Unit 3. Generally, it's kind of a boring job because, the expectation was we weren't going to find anything. So I was passing through the cold machine shop with my GM, which is a radiation counter, and all of a sudden I came up on this piece of pipe that was about 14 inches in diameter and about 20 inches long, big, heavy cast iron pipe, and my GM started going crazy. You get sporadic background counts, and that's what you would expect, but when I came up on this piece of pipe, I said, wow, this thing's contaminated. And behind the welding curtain was a welder. I said, do you know anything about that piece of pipe that's on the workbench? And he said, yes, I put it there. I said, what? Do you know that that piece of pipe is radioactively contaminated? And he says, no, I didn't know that. I said, where did you get it? He says, out of the scrap metal bin. So I made a trip to the scrap metal bin, then came back and told him, I says, the bin is empty. He says, well, that's strange, because when I pulled this piece of pipe out, there was a whole bunch of it in there. The scrap metal bins were overflowing with stuff, and mostly this pipe. And it turns out that this pipe was a long section of suppression chamber pipe that was taken out of the reactor containment system. And it couldn't be taken out as one whole piece. It had to be cut into sections in order to get it out. And so I went to the maintenance foreman, and I asked the maintenance foreman, I said, what happened to the scrap metal that was in the scrap metal bin? And he says, well, GNR scrap metal came and picked it up. And I said, well, did you know that there's one section of pipe that's on the workbench that's radioactively contaminated? He says, no. Did you see any kind of an unconditional release tag on that piece of pipe or any of the other pipe? And he says, no. And I said, do you see any paperwork on it? No. And I said, well, who ordered for the pickup by GNR scrap metal? He said, the front office did. I says, don't you normally do that? And he said, well, yeah, but in this case, the front office made the arrangements to have GNR come and pick it up. So then I contacted the radiation protection engineer and told him what I had discovered. And I said, we need to go down to GNR and look for that pipe and survey it all out and bring back to the plant any of it that's contaminated. And it's reasonable to assume that it was all contaminated because this is just one section of a continuous run of pipe. Turns out there was actually long pieces of pipe that was cut into sections. My book explains the rest of that story. They never did produce the documentation. It was in violation of the license requirements that PG&E was operating under. And I even went out to where all this stuff is archived to see if it had ended up out there. And I certainly knew my way around looking for old records. I didn't find anything in there. And so I had to come to the only conclusion that made any sense is that somebody in the middle of the night took that stuff out of the controlled area and took it to the scrap metal bins and then called GNR scrap metal to come and pick it up. And if the welder hadn't picked up that one piece of pipe, no one would have ever been the wiser, and that would have been the end of the story. Why would they have disposed of it that way? It was a lot cheaper to have GNR scrap metal pick it up than to dispose of it as radioactive waste. In fact, PG&E even made some money on it.
Who knows where it ended up, which is, just one example of the many stories that you talk about in this book that led a lot of people to resist the building of new nuclear power plants because of the kinds of things that happened due to either human error or herd thinking or profit motivation or some combination of all of those things. One of the stories that you tell in Chapter 8 is about your discovery that there were these mysterious radioactive particles that were all over people's clothes outside of the area where they would be expected to be contaminated. Why don't you tell just a little bit about that story, that what you call the mysterious particles?
I was on the rad protection desk the day that the first of these particles were discovered, doing some paperwork in a radiation control log, and the hand and foot counter was directly behind me. There were people coming and going, and when they left Unit 3, they had to use the hand and foot counter to check out. That was mandatory. And so an employee climbed up on that thing and set off the alarms big time. And I jumped up and ran around. I said, what's going on? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, you're crapped up. And I looked at the digital readouts. I said, your hands are okay, but there's a problem with your shoes. I said, step off. And I took his shoes from him. And the left one was okay, but the right one was grossly contaminated. When I stuck a GM up to it, it saturated the tube. So I had to grab a CP, a cutie pie, which is a dose rate instrument. And it read 2-3 Rankins per hour. I said, man, why? This is... anyway, we went into the nuclear instrumentation lab where they had a piece of plastic laid down. We call it acetate. And so I laid that down and put on surgical gloves because of the handling, and I didn't want to get it on my hands. And then I put a pair of goggles on because I didn't know what kind of radiation we're dealing with, and it could have been high-energy beta. And that can penetrate the eyes. And so, long story short, by the process of taking a roll of masking tape and turning sticky side out, I rolled it across the sole of the shoe with a lot of hard pressure. And finally, the shoe came clean, but the tape was grossly contaminated. So I took the tape and I cut it into smaller and smaller pieces until I had a piece about the size of a postage stamp. Took it and put it underneath the magnifying glass, and I could see a black speck. That was the culprit. And it was a lot hotter than 2 to 3 R per hour because it was a pinpoint source, and the cutie pie could not accurately measure a pinpoint source. So if it's measuring 2 to 3 R, whatever that was a heck of a lot hotter than just what the CP was indicating. So I called the radiation protection engineer up so that he could take a look at what I had found. The employee had said, I don't know how I would have gotten something like that on me because I was never in the controlled area of the radiation controlled area. It was in the control room, but it's not to be confused with the radiation controlled area. You had to go into another room and then go across what we called the access pad or step-off pad to get into the radiation controlled area. He had not even gone into the radiation controlled area. And even if he had booties and rubber galoshes on that would have protected his shoes from picking up anything anyway. So that had to have been picked up either in the control room or out and about in the clean areas of the plant, units 1 and 2, or out in the yard or someplace. And I pointed this out to the radiation protection engineer, and he refused to acknowledge what I had told him. He took that piece of tape and he threw it in a low-level radiation waste storage box. He was a radiation protection engineer who had a degree in air conditioning, said, oh, that's okay, don't worry about it. And I said, no, it's an improper way of disposing something like that. Don't put it in a low-level radiation waste storage. We had a high-level radiation waste storage vault, which is another part of my book. There's all kinds of problems with that. But anyway, that was just the first of many. We started experiencing more and more and more of those. And many of the employees who were picking these things up hadn't been in the radiation control area at all. And even if they had, like I said previously, they couldn't have picked it up on their shoes anyway. But we were also finding it on the trousers, especially in the seams of trousers. So I kept pressing for an answer. I said, what is the source of these particles? And I was finally told by the radiation protection engineer that it was Chinese fallout. And the Chinese were doing atomic testing in the atmosphere during the latter part of the 60s. But I said, I'm not going to buy that story unless or until the California Department of Public Health picks this stuff up along the coastline from Southern California to Oregon and then Washington and then Alaska. But some of the atmospheric conditions of radiation levels was increasing a bit because of the stuff that was coming from the bomb testing. But hot particles, I know of none of them that were discovered anyplace but at our plant. The assumption was that our plant was generating those things. They're either coming out of the 250-foot radioactive gaseous waste discharge stack that PG&E and the NRC nowadays loves to call the ventilation stack, or it was coming from the high-level radiation waste storage vault, which did not have any kind of enclosure over it. When we lifted the lid off that vault, everything inside of it was exposed to the atmosphere, and on windy days, anything that was loose in there could just blow out. And it's spelled out in my book. I went in and told the plant engineer, I says, look, the only thing protecting the kids downwind from our high-level radiation waste storage vault, it was students at the South Bay Elementary School, the only thing protecting them is a chain link fence. And I got in a lot of trouble for that.
If you're just joining us, this is the Eco News Report. I'm Jen Kalt, and I'm interviewing Bob Rowan, who was a nuclear control technician and whistleblower at the PG&E Humboldt Bay Nuclear Power Plant at King Salmon from 1964 to 1970. And he's here to talk about his new book that tells a lot of these stories and why he was fired by PG&E, amongst other things that happened later.
This is an Eco News Report Encore presentation, originally aired February 26, 2015.
The mysterious particle story leads to the story about the South Bay Elementary School monitor. So there were environmental monitors that PG&E had in various locations from, I think, Fortuna to Trinidad. Is that
Fickle
right?
Hill.
Fickle Hill.
Behind Humboldt State.
And the South Bay Elementary School was just right across the freeway from the PG&E plant and downwind from the prevailing northwest winds. And they had a monitor there until...
Okay, we started out in 64 doing the radiological monitoring programs in the environment all over Humboldt Hill, and as you say, from Fortuna through the city of Eureka on up to Pickle Hill behind Humboldt State College in Arcata. We had 5 constant air sample monitor locations, and one of those was at Station 14, which is in the front of South Bay Elementary School. That station reported the highest readings of all the stations in the whole monitoring program. We went from doing those surveys every month to every 3 weeks, to every 2 weeks, to every week as the radiation levels climbed in the plant. And, of course, there's a story behind why those levels climbed. It had to do with the failure of the initial loading of the core stainless steel cladding, and everything became grossly contaminated. But anyway, I was the control technician on duty in probably the late January, early February of 1970, and I was doing this whole survey, and I got to Station 14 in front of the elementary school. Station 14 had been completely removed. The only thing left were the 2 dosimeters on the crossarm up above where Station 14 had previously existed, but the constant air sample monitor was gone. And so I went over to the plant, which is just a 3-minute drive, and I said, "Where's the Station 14 constant air sample monitor?" And he said, "Well, the company decided it was no longer needed." And I says, "Why?" "That was the most important component of the entire monitoring program." And he said, "Well, now you need to understand the difference between your role as a control technician and management's prerogative to do what management feels is appropriate." And I said, "Well, that station should never have been removed." And I said, "But I want to know why. Why? Why was it removed?" And I also wanted to see the results of the test that was done on the filters, because the constant air sample monitor pulled a measured amount of air through it 24/7, and it was searching for particulate matter. That's what it was there for. And so I was never allowed to see the results. I don't know if anyone ever was allowed to see the results. It was very suspicious to me. And so that was one of the things I brought up at the infamous May 20th, 1970 safety meeting, along with some other issues. But that was central to my concerns, and Forrest William brought some up too. And we were shortly thereafter out the door, both of us. He went first. A week later, I was gone.
Well, there are quite a number of these type of stories, including the leaky spent fuel pool contaminating groundwater beneath the plant. There's a story about, it's a fairly ridiculous story about them bringing in rabbits to test for iodine-131, whether they were eating it in the grass outside the plant, and how the rabbits ended up being fed with feed that was purchased at a local feed store rather than the grass that they were supposed to be testing. And then one of the ones that really stunned me as far as just the sheer sloppiness of the way that plant was run was your story about the cardboard boxes where the low-level radioactive waste was contained within cardboard boxes that were lined with plastic, and the storage room got too full, so they left them outside, and then the wind and rain came and ripped open the plastic over the top of it, and it was a leaky, soggy mess that got shoved into a semi-truck and trickled radioactive water all the way up 101 and 299 to wherever it was taken. But one of the stories I really want you to talk about is the spent fuel shipping cask and the measurements that you took from that. Why don't you tell the story? You can tell it better than I can.
Okay, we had an 80-ton spent fuel shipping cask that was brought into the plant. For an underwater transfer from the spent fuel pool into the shipping cask, the spent fuel that was ready to be sent back to the reprocessing plant in New York. You know, it was routine for a period of time, and they were working around the clock 24/7 in an attempt to decontaminate the shipping cask. And I explain in my book exactly that whole process, how that worked. But when the cask was finally stationed at the decon area and all the final attempts to decontaminate the cask were made, it was determined that the middle fin area of the cask was grossly contaminated and could not be further decontaminated with the methods that we were using. It was determined, though, that the top almost third and the bottom third of the cask was cooler, except for the top seal of the cask, which was grossly contaminated. Over 20,000 counts was measured. And unbeknownst to us, Forrest Williams and Raymond Skidmore and I, and mostly Raymond Skidmore and myself, were working on decontaminating the cask. along with shift helpers and control operators and others and mechanics that were called in to decontaminate the cask. Well, what we discovered was that by midday of August 6, 1969, that cask was not going to get further decontaminated with the methods that we were using. But meanwhile, PG&E had contacted NWP, Northwestern Pacific Railway, to come in and pick up that cask, which was put on a special railroad car and then shipped out. When we made the final determinations, and there's a little more detail in this event in my book, but when we made the final determinations of the smear samples that the radiation protection engineer wanted us to use, the counts were over 2,600 disintegrations per minute per 100 square centimeters, and DOT reg said that the contamination levels had to be less than 2,200 disintegrations per minute per 100 square centimeters. And we made the calculation. He said, okay, that's fine, sign it. And he wanted me to sign it because my name had been pre-typed on the release forms. And I says, I'm not signing those release papers because it's a lie. And so I dug my heels in, and he called the front office and talked to the plant engineer. And the plant engineer told him, I won't use the language that... I said, well, okay, I'm going to sign it, but I'm signing it under protest. And so I signed the paper, and then he immediately took the papers down to the front office because they had to make the final arrangements with NWP. And it was right at the end of the working day for me because our normal day ended at 4:30. So I went out to the radiation control log, and I wrote in the radiation control log exactly what had taken place. And that is quoted in my book. It provides an excellent example of how PG&E would respond to that kind of behavior on the part of a control technician. Because the next morning when I arrived at work, with 1 minute into the workday, I was called to the front office and raked over the coals for making that entry into the radiation control log. And it recorded precisely what had taken place. It was nothing more than just a clear, honest statement of what had taken place. Included in that statement was the fact that the middle areas of the cask were predetermined to be a lot hotter than the top and bottom quadrants. And so I put that in there. I said the 2,615 disintegrations per minute per 100 square centimeter didn't even begin to represent the true condition of the cask. But what happened was it was eventually investigated by the DOT, which deferred to the AEC, which deferred to PG&E, and said, well, we made a call to the DOT and the DOT representative. He said, well, it was only like 10 or 15% over, so it doesn't matter. And he just wouldn't like to see this happen all the time. Well, if it was within the measurable limits, which it wasn't, well, then why wouldn't that be okay anytime, not just in this particular case? Why would he say, well, but not in this instance? We wouldn't want to see it happen again, you know. So anyway, it was another one of those things that got me in a lot of hot water.
So there's another story that I read in your book, and it's about the painters who were found outside the fence who actually had quite a bit of radioactive contamination on their clothing, and you found that they had taken the radiation home with them. But we don't have time to get too into that story because I really want you to talk a little bit about the big picture. Recently, some whistleblowers who are biologists with the Bureau of Reclamation came out with a story about the Klamath River water management and the misuse of funds for that environmental protection. But at the time that all this was going on with PG&E and you were, you know, basically a whistleblower, there was no such thing at that time as whistleblower protection. Is that right?
That's correct.
But you were a member of the union.
Yes.
And so I really want people to get the picture of what happened to you after you were fired, because your son writes a very moving foreword in the beginning of your book about being a young child and the fear that he experienced, the sort of unnamed fear because phoned in death threats and that sort of thing. This is an important part of the story, what happened to you after you were fired.
I discovered a police report that had been written by Chief Emmeiser and PG&E's senior security agent, Bert Jones. They collaborated on a report that was intended to make us a security risk. I wasn't ever supposed to see that police report, but a law enforcement officer came across his desk and he made copies of it and he showed it to me. And I couldn't believe what I was reading. We were involved in acts tantamount to industrial sabotage that advocated violence and firebombing and the overthrow of the government. It was an awful, awful document. Chief Emmeiser's willingness to participate in this stemmed from an incident that took place with police brutality that motivated him to cooperate with PG&E. Later, he said he wished he had never done that, but nonetheless, he did it. And my wife and I tried to shield our kids from what was happening to us. with the death threats, and she was constantly harassed by the police department, the Eureka Police Department, and so was I. And we told our kids, never, don't answer the telephone. But my oldest boy, not always minding his parents, answered the phone, and he received a death threat. It wasn't really intended for him, but he's the one that got it. And he was 6 years old. All of this is clearly spelled out in my book. I didn't think these kind of things happened in America. I was pretty naive. And when I served in the military, I truly believed in America. And I believed in corporate America because I thought the corporate America was the strength of America. I mean, corporate America supplied us with all the tools and equipment we needed to go to war with and to defend democracy around the globe, wherever that might take us and so forth. But I learned through this experience that there's a whole different view that I now hold of corporate America and the government. I mean, I'm not anti-government, but my motivation for writing this book is to educate people. What they want to do with it is up to them. And I hope I can get into the classrooms at Humboldt State and CR, as well as other places, and explain what took place. And so that they can say, well, you know, we better pay closer attention because, you know, PG&E and the AEC tried to build an atomic plant at Bodega Bay, and the highly sophisticated folks down there said, no way. They tried to do the same thing at Mendocino and Point Arena, and those sophisticated folks said, no way. But guess what happened to Humboldt County? Humboldt County people and the people that live on Humboldt Hill got sold a bill of goods. That plant was dangerous, and for the reasons that are spelled out in my book, you cannot trust the operators of nuclear power or the people who are responsible for regulating nuclear power. I'm trying to get that story out in the few days I have left on this planet. So that's where I'm coming from.
Well, I thank you, Bob, so much for coming and being on the Eco News Report and for writing your book and getting these stories out. You know, these are important parts of the legacy of the past here on Humboldt Bay. You know, the people on Humboldt Hill and to the southeast of the nuclear power plant and the pulp mills have all suffered a great cost. And I can only hope that we can learn from the lessons of the past and not keep making the same mistakes over and over again. There is a number of old nuclear power plants on the East Coast that were threatened by Hurricane Sandy. Many of them will probably be shut down in the next decade or so. The two in Southern California have been shut down. San Onofre was shut down.
And they're trying to shut down Diablo Canyon. There's
right.
a movement afoot right now. And Rancho Seco has been shut down.
Rancho Seco
That's
near
not a
Sacramento,
PG&E facility,
right? That's been shut down for a while. You know, the power plants are shut down for decades to let cool off, and then the decommissioning begins. That's why the decommissioning here didn't begin for almost 30 years after the shutdown. With the threat of earthquakes and tsunamis and rising seas, we can only hope that these errors of the past can be somewhat alleviated before something even worse than the chronic health problems that people have suffered. Reading your book and thinking about the environmental struggles that are going on all over the planet with regard to energy consumption, you know, whether it be coal export or the tar sands and fracking, all of these issues, energy production is really one of the most toxic and devastating things we humans do. And the reality is that we're all complicit in it every time we turn the thermostat on or dry our clothes in the dryer, and we need to figure out a better way. And I just hope that good old Yankee ingenuity is going to come through, and a lot of really smart people are going to come up with brilliant ways to make a lot of money off things that are clean and green. Let's hope for that. So thanks for being with us today, Bob. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This has been the Eco News Report. This is Jennifer Cault with Humboldt Baykeeper. My guest today was Bob Rowan, former nuclear control technician and whistleblower from the PG&E Humboldt Bay Nuclear Power Plant at King Salmon. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org. Previous shows are also posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. The Eco News Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again for the Eco News Report.
This has been an Eco News Report Encore presentation, originally aired February 26, 2015.